S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the special mailbag edition this Sunday. With me, I'm Scott Phillips.
Firstly.
With me, as always, Dr. Anirvan Ohati. How are you, Doc?
I am all right. I could always be better, but I am all right.
Is that glass half full or glass half empty?
Well, you know, the market is down and all those things are going on. Coronavirus is still around, so I don't know what I can say good.
Just think of all the upside potential.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of the downside potential too. The upside potential is there if I don't die of corona, right?
They say the optimist thinks the glass half full, the pessimist says it's half empty, and the realist knows it needs to be washed up. So, make of that what you will. And that's a lovely way to start our mailbag.
Actually, you need to wash your glasses these days properly. Because I read somewhere that, you know, coronavirus can live on glass for like 4 days or something like that.
Oh, man. The realist knows the hand sanitizer is required at all times. All right. We've started with a tangent, which is nice because our regular listeners will know that's exactly. If we didn't, they'd be worried about us still, I think.
That is true.
They know the world is still turning while we're over doing tangents. Mate, let's crack straight in. We've got a heap of questions. I'm going to try desperately to not add too much to your wonderful answers. We'll try and see how quickly we can get through more of these questions than we otherwise might be able to. What do you reckon?
Let's do it.
All right. I should say, by the way, we got a question from Chris about the EX20, which actually was the same question we received from Craig on Friday's podcast. So, Chris, I will assume our Friday question answered your question along with Craig's answer, the idea of being companies outside the top 20, investing in those to avoid banking and mining exposure. So we'll move on past Chris's question, but mate, thank you for adding yours. Next question from Steve. Steve says, hey, guys, love the podcast. Not sure if this is the correct platform to ask a question, but I will attempt it anyway. Steve, you have nailed it in one, mate. This is it. My partner and I were having a drink on Friday after the chaos, and we decided to log in our respective super accounts to have a laugh at the losses. I love that approach. I'm down a sizable chunk, ouch, but when my partner opened her account, she found she was 100% in cash. Talk about a nice surprise, at least in this environment. After panicking, telling her she had missed out on 10 years of gains, what is a sensible step from here? High growth? Thanks, Steve. So Steve's right? Like over the last 3 months, it felt great being in cash. Over the previous 10 years, it was terrible being in cash. Both those things are in the past though, Doc, as we say. It doesn't really matter what happened in the past. All that matters is what happens from here. So Steve's in shares. His partner's in cash. So again, in the short term, she takes the biggies or he takes the biggies. In the long term, it's Steve. What do we do from here, mate?
Yeah, like I mean, mate, here the issue here is again, can't give personal advice. We don't know how many years of investing they have ahead of them. But you know, like I'll just try to answer that generically. If somebody has got many years of, like, you know, let's say a decade plus of investing ahead of them, then I mean, you know, right now the shares are definitely attractive in the sense that the prices have come down. The price to earnings on a trailing basis look attractive, of course. Maybe I'm not so on a forward basis because the forward earnings are going to compress because of, you know, coronavirus. But if you look forward, let's say you take a 10-year view, many businesses would be earning, I would think, a lot more than they earned in last year or 2019, right, in 10 years' time. I truly believe that in 10 years' time, we would look at this and say, well, this was a blip. It was painful, it was hard, but you know, we always have these blips that we get over. And frankly, if we don't get over this, well, then, you know, whether or not you have money really wouldn't matter, because then life would really not be good. And then probably we'd be all hiding in some cave with sticks in our hands.
Right.
I do think that, you know, as the humankind, we will persevere and we will excel. So my thought would be I'd be actually invested in the share market. Whether how aggressive really is it is really a personal question. How aggressively they want to invest, but I would really be invested in the share market with a decade plus horizon. That's just sort of my general view. That's what I am doing. I'm really investing with even like in a two decade view.
Nice. I'm going to try not to over. I guess I'm trying to stick to my resolution of not saying the same thing as Doc just said. So I completely agree with everything you said. I think in terms of growth, just remember you're going to be investing, hopefully, if you build a decent enough nest egg by retirement, well and truly past retirement. So even if you're going to retire in 15 years, hopefully you're investing for another 25 or 30 after that. So really your time horizon is still going to be maybe even 45 years from here, if you're 50, for example. So thinking about that in the context of then how you think about growth, I absolutely agree that a growth strategy, if you're not going to need the capital In other words, if you live on the dividends or even sell down small amounts of shares to fund your expenses, run them to cash the whole thing out. So it depends on what phase you're in, how much money you're going to have by retirement. But yes, absolutely shares. I think growth generally. I really desperately hate the super fund allocations of conservative balance, growth, high growth, all that kind of rubbish. It's just not very helpful. And I also don't love the way they talk about that, because really what they're saying is not, you know, balance will do less than growth over time. So who in their right mind would choose balance over growth? Except balance has that kind of nice, you know, kind of connotation of, oh, it's sensible, it's thoughtful, and it's a really good idea. Who would choose a lower return if they had the option of a higher return? It makes absolutely no sense. What they're really talking about is the amount of volatility. And if you can, your partner can withstand the volatility, shares have always done, you know, the higher proportion you got in shares over time have always done better than a higher proportion or a lesser proportion in shares and a higher proportion in any other asset class. So generally speaking, if you've got a long enough time horizon, I think shares are a wonderful place to be. High growth, look, it depends how they define that. But generally speaking, yeah, I would be on the heavier shares as a proportion of the total and of whatever allocation they gave the description. Any more on Doc on that?
No, I think nothing, not.
Beautiful. Yeah. Question from Chris, mate. Hi, legends. I've bought the dip and I think I'll do well in the long run, but I'm worried about a Great Depression looming. If I were to buy a put option around the current prices to cancel out major downside, what option would you recommend and how do I buy it? Doc, our listeners know very well that all I know about options is how to spell it. So I'm going to throw this one straight to you and see if you have any thoughts on Chris's question.
Yes. So, okay. So, I mean, a put option, you could, if you're long a put or you buy a put, that basically gives you, effectively, it is it's like a hedge.
It's an insurance policy, right?
It's an insurance policy. So you're going to be paying some premium for it. And effectively, the hedge starts working at a price, the strike price of the current put at which you bought the put, mm-hmm. plus the premium that you've paid. So if the put says at, let's assume an index put,
yes.
and the index is at say 5,000, and yep. if I've got a put that basically hedges me say from 4,800, right, then I start making money only when the index falls below 4,800.
Okay.
Plus the amount I've paid in premium, which is insurance.
Right.
Right. And so if I paid like, you know, another 100 or 200 points on that, then basically I start making only when the index falls below 4,600.
So even in theory, when your put is making money in itself, you may still not be covering your costs. So you're not really making money.
Yeah. So this really only works well when there's substantial movement. Like, you know, if the market were to fall another 20% or something yeah. like that, then yeah. you would make money on the put.
But it wouldn't, I mean, you'd have to have a lot of that invested to cover an entire portfolio, right? The dollar value of the put you'd have to buy and the insurance premium you'd have to pay to cover your entire current portfolio. I know nothing about it. I don't know how the maths works out, but
it'll be substantial. Yeah.
And if it doesn't work out for you, you're really harming a decent chunk of your portfolio, right?
Yeah. So the way most people, like, you know, most professional managers who do this sort of thing would work with, and in the past when I have done it, is you tend to, like, you know, decide what percentage of portfolio you want to protect. You probably protect only 10 to 15%, maybe 20% of your portfolio.
Right.
That's what you buy in as a hedge. Most of the time, you're going to let your hedge expire. And that's a good thing because it's just like buying. It's just like buying insurance.
Yeah, yeah.
You have lost money paying for the insurance, but then the remainder of your portfolio, 80% of your portfolio, has actually gone up.
Yeah.
So it's okay. And sometimes what you could do is, like, you know, people who play with index, like if you think of the index, you could actually finance the put by selling a put at a lower strike price.
Right.
So that gives you protection between the higher strike price and the lower strike price.
Yeah.
But you're effectively buying the market at the lower price
yeah.
because you're obliged to buy the market at the lower price. But that works okay because, at least in this particular in situation, it might be okay because if the market has already fallen 30%
yep.
and you're committing to buy the market at, say, after it falls another 20%,
right.
more likely than not, at that point, you're actually going to be making money. So yeah. it's okay to buy the market. And if, you know, so you're using the lower price to pay off some of the premium that you've been. So that's another. Personally, I have, you know, I've gone from hedging to not hedging. I'm actually not hedged at all, really, at this point.
Yeah.
And what I rather prefer is if you've got some cash, then I always treat the cash actually as a hedge because that's probably the best
right,
hedge.
Right, right, right.
Right? You've got the cash and you can deploy the cash. If you really are, you know, want to smooth out volatility, that's another thing. I mean, again, this is, this gets into the behavioral part. Yeah. Some people really like to do that because they, you know, they're smoothing out their returns. It's also smoothing out the upside as well, because you're paying for the premium, right? So you're getting less upside, less downside. Yeah. So if you're happy taking the volatility, then cash, in my view, is the best hedge.
Yep.
In that sense, the next best hedge is an index spread put, as described, because you're buying the index at a much lower price.
I'm an eternal optimist, mate, but I reckon the best hedge is actually to be fully invested, because when the market goes up, you get the full value from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's mostly true. Like, again, like this, you know, the thing is that you are right, right? Market goes up more often than it doesn't.
Yep.
Therefore, if you're fully invested, you're better off. But it's the side thing is that you want to be invested in a way that makes you comfortable.
Totally.
And if that means you're going to be invested 80% and 20% in cash, that's for you.
Totally. And right? I think that, to Chris, that's the answer. Chris talks about a Great Depression, right? I mean, if you honestly think this market goes down another 80%, then sell your shares now, because you're better off having the cash than having any sort of option, right? Because if you're going to cover 50% of your 10%, 15%, 25% of your portfolio, the other half or 80% still going to fall if the market falls so dramatically. If you really honestly think this is Great Depression time, then I don't think you can probably, you have to hedge your whole portfolio, which would cost you a fortune premiums. Even if you are right, you would have been better being cash anyway, to redeploy that cash at, you know, whatever expectation you have of where the market falls to. Because again, that put pays you out, but only at a certain level. If it falls further from there, you're still on your own. So Doc's point is exactly right. I personally think hedging is a bit of a folly the way it's sold, because they're selling lack of volatility without you really knowing that's what you're kind of buying. It feels, they sell it as being smarter and making money in all markets, and that all feels kind of somehow good. But you need to be really honest with yourself and others. As Doc's already said, it's purely behavioral. If you feel better having cash, do that. If you feel better with a put, by all means do that. Just be mindful that you're paying for the privilege. And maybe it pays off, right? But the problem is over time, it doesn't pay off. In fact, after the market's fallen this far, the chance that you make money from holding or owning shares rather than trying to profit from further losses, the odds are against you profiting from further losses to the same degree as you were putting that money into shares and holding them for the long term. So just be thoughtful about that. I saw some numbers recently. It's just phenomenally, yeah, the returns are much, much better to own shares once the market's fallen by meaningful amounts than trying to profit from further falls. Doesn't mean that can't happen or won't happen, just that on average over time, even if it works out this time, the probability is that it won't work out the next half dozen times. And so when you start a strategy like this, you're probably going to cost yourself money rather than make it over the long term.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to a question from Mark for Scott and Doc's mailbag. He says, it's Wednesday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. Since this drama started, I've lost 16% of my portfolio. Pretty devastating. I can assure you, as I'm retired and just had crossed a line where I don't have to save anymore, but can just start spending. So 16% is a lot. But the ASX is down 28% and the NASDAQ is down 24%, Dow down 32%. Am I doing well, or should I be dragged down the road tarred and feathered? I'm active with international ETFs, including NASDAQ, Asia, Tech Tigers, and CSL, etc. I don't do bonds, cash, etc. So I guess Mark's question is twofold, mate. Is he doing well? But I think to some degree too, he's also looking at the market saying, I'm down, it hurts a lot. Kind of just, what would you say to Mark?
Well, Mark, mate, I mean, like, you're definitely doing better than the market, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a win.
Yep.
And you know, I'd take that win right now, because, I mean, you're basically beating the market. Yes, you're beating the market by being down, but you're still beating the market, which is a good spot to be. And I mean, you know, nobody can predict if in the interim the market is going to go further down, or it's going to bounce around, or it's going to go up. I mean, you know, there are various types of charts that I see that, you know, people make based on previous episodes like this. But, you know, if every episode was identical or similar to the past episode, then there would be no problem and we'd all be geniuses. But, you know, so part of the thing is that we wouldn't know what to do. I think being retired actually is a very, it throws unique challenges, because if you're getting no new cash and you're seeing sort of your portfolio getting dissipated to some extent, you know, although it's dissipated to a lower extent, that is really going to hurt.
Right.
It also is going to hurt because you are potentially playing with a much larger amount, right? 16% of a larger amount is, I mean, fundamentally 16% of one $100,000, 16% of $1 million, it's still 16%.
That's right.
But the buying, but yes, honestly, yes, it doesn't really work that way, right?
Because
16% for $1 million is a lot of money.
Correct.
Because for most people, that is actually a lot of money. That's
three or four new cars, mate.
You know, three and four, or you know, or one, you know, one fancy car,
yeah, correct.
Or you know, or a fancy boat or something like that. But you know, whatever it is, like, I mean, it is psychologically very hard.
Totally, mate.
But you know what, I think, like as Scott answered the previous question, if somebody's just retired, they've probably got another, you know, 20, 25 years of life left. They're probably going to be investing. There's probably some dividends coming through from, if you have quality companies, they're probably going to pay some dividends still.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of investing. I guess somebody who has invested their life probably knows this already. So I'm just probably repeating everything that they know, everything that Mark knows in this context. So, mm-hmm. Just weathering it through, and you know, I would not think that just because the indices are down so much that you should also be down.
Yeah,
that
right.
Your diversification and your allocation and your strategy is working for you in this instance.
Yep.
So yeah, I take that as a win.
It's absolutely a win, Mark. I'm going to only add to disagree with Doc only slightly, not really, just to give a different perspective, which is I don't reckon you should take any 5-6 week period and try and assess whether or not you're doing well or badly as an investment strategy. Other than if you had deliberately invested to try and minimize downside or minimize volatility, and you expected this would happen. If you just said, look, I want a portfolio that only falls by half of the market's falls, then I think that's you've done the right thing. If it's like, I bought the stocks I wanted to buy, it just so happens they're down this much, but I still believe in the long term, then that's a different story altogether. If I'd have owned a portfolio that was down 60% right now, for example, I'd be pretty unhappy. But if I did it in the view that over 5 or 10 years I was going to make a lot more money, I'd happily accept that volatility for the return. So my overarching comment, I suppose, mate, is I get it. Look, you're doing very well relative to the market, as Ox already said. All I would say is maybe try to whatever extent you can to wean yourself off short-term movements and short-term relative movements compared to the market. I've had periods where stocks have gone down, have gone nowhere. Other periods when they've gone up really fast. And sometimes at complete odds to where the market's going. That's just kind of what happens because sentiment changes and people change their minds. So great result. Really happy for you. This volatility isn't over, by the way. So expect that you may well lose more from here and the market may lose more from here. Or frankly, because you've lost less, maybe the market recovers faster than your portfolio does. That's all completely okay. Yes, we think you should keep score. Yes, we think you should try and beat the market where you can. Far more importantly, though, is a strategy that you like, that you are bought into, that you feel great about. And even though it hurts when you lose money over the long term, if you see that portfolio making money for you and funding your lifestyle, that's the one you should be great and happy to own, regardless of what happened over the last 6 months. Or 6 weeks, I should say, not 6 months. Any more on that, Doc?
No, I have nothing to add.
Question from Peter. Hi, Scott. A big shout out to you and the Doc throughout the coronavirus crisis. Your foolish banter and insights have been a calming influence in what has been a very unsettling event for many. Thank you, Peter. It's very kind. Thinking the time is right to start a plan for the future that will never be the same post the crisis. Love your combined thoughts on what trends will be accelerated, e.g. a heightened awareness around health and well-being, an accelerated move to the e-wallet, more work from home, etc. So, Doc, I love this because you are a resident futurist. So I may have a couple of thoughts at the end, but I probably won't. Your thoughts, mate, on what trends are being accelerated from this crisis and the ones maybe that we should be careful not to accelerate, the ones that maybe, you know, both sides of that coin. Where are the opportunities and where are the maybe the watch-outs that might seem obvious now, but in the fullness of time may not necessarily be the sort of trends that people expect?
Yeah, I love this question, actually. So one of the things about, so I guess at a very high level, I think of this from a habit formation point of view, right? And this is pretty unique in terms of what is happening with the coronavirus is, you know, most countries are forcing their citizens en masse to do certain things. Now, the question is, how long does this go on? Behavioral scientists would say that something between, you know, 3 months to 6 months actually does change behavior, right? And certain things then can have spiraling effects, right? So one of the interesting things here is if businesses think that work from home actually is working reasonably well, then that has effect on how businesses going forward think about, you know, allocation of offices and things like that, right? So think about commercial real estate, right? How is commercial real estate going to be impacted if offices need to be only provisioned at, say, 60% or 70% of what they're provisioned right now?
Right.
Because A, you provide the flexibility of work from home, and B, it doesn't compromise your workflow, and C, the employees get flexibility because, and employees probably save time, right? Think about how it impacts cities and things like that. It even impacts city planning. If people actually, if even 20% of the people decide to work from home and this becomes the norm, then that changes a lot of things, even in terms of, so there's cascading effects that can happen. That's one. Work from home is definitely, so software, tools, services that enable work from home, I think that was already happening. That is likely to accelerate. At least that's what I think. The other thing that's interesting is it to some extent, the power of the cloud has been in full force. So in a way, people are working from home, but most of the time, what we are using is cloud solutions, right? And even if you think about coronavirus and how the data is being collected and how the data is being disseminated, that is also being enabled by cloud services. So various, cloud data services or cloud data crunching platforms, they're being used to assimilate, collect, analyze the data. So I think that trend accelerates, in my view. So then that has impact on not just cloud services at the top layer, but also in terms of just the cloud infrastructure providers, right? In terms of how the infrastructure is being provided and provisioned for the cloud.
Yep.
So that's an interesting area. Another one that it's kind of maybe obvious, but is e-commerce, right? Now, if you think about e-commerce penetration as a fraction of total retail, it was probably 10, 12%. I'm just giving you US figures, but it's that figure is roughly consistent across sort of the most of the Western developed world, right?
Okay.
And 12 to 15% sort of penetration levels.
US a little bit ahead of everybody else, I think?
No. Or
we caught up now?
I think it's probably the same in Europe. That's my guess.
Cool,
but
yeah.
It's actually, the penetration of e-commerce is higher in some developing countries because, or in China, for example, because, again, infrastructure investing countries have been provisioned to facilitate people to actually come and shop, right? Whereas in many places, it's actually easier to just get the package delivered to you because it's not as convenient to go to the shop.
Yeah.
Being India being an example, right? If you have to travel 3 hours to get to the shop, why would you do that? It requires a lot of
travel.
Right? So that, I think e-commerce definitely gets a lift. And even just, if you get used to buying certain things on e-commerce, you just find it's very convenient. That definitely gets a lift. The other thing related to that would be, I think of coronavirus and how people are actually unwilling to actually touch cash.
Yeah, right.
Businesses are now asking that you actually pay waves.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. Supermarket, petrol stations I've been to in the last week.
They're really not wanting to take cash. So I think a move to e-payments, electronic payments, cashless society can definitely get a lift. This, if I was a Reserve Bank, this is probably what I'd do. I'd say no cash anymore. We're just going to go electronic. And one of the best parts of that is it removes a lot of the cash that slushes around in the economy but never gets shown to the tax man. That gets actually eradicated as well. This is
that's
really
gonna make
cool.
Some people unhappy, mate.
Well, but it makes more cash. I mean, there's another way to think of it: more cash for the government, more tax for the government, more services for us, right? I mean, assuming the government does the right thing with the money. That's that. The another thing that has, I think, it's going to get a huge boost is telehealth, right? And that's sort of it seems counterintuitive, and there's a lot of bureaucracy dragging their feet at telehealth, but a lot of things can be done via telehealth. And now, even here in Australia, for example, Medicare is now supporting telehealth for GPs and things like that, and even for specialists. But it comes with a time frame. Oh, we are supporting this until September 30th. I mean, the reason is, why wouldn't we support this beyond September 30th? Because, and I get it, there are instances where a doctor has to absolutely see the patient, right? But modern medical care is all based on assessment from tests. And, you know, an Australian doctor typically does not actually need to see the patient and touch the patient. Okay, you need to maybe feel the heart. But if you can get the heart measurement done at home, right? And if you describe, the patient describes the feature, and you don't have to actually collect. If you need some specimen collected, that specimen can be collected at a specialized lab, right?
Okay. So the initial consultation, as opposed, I mean, obviously the specialist needs to do their thing, or the lab collection needs to do their thing in person.
Yeah.
But some of the diagnosis or some of the referrals can be done online.
Yeah. So like for example, for my wife is an obstetrician and gynecologist. What she is doing is most of her initial consult, because she needs to see, she needs to do a physical examination as a gynae. So she's doing that. But all the follow-up stuff she's actually trying to do on telehealth,
right,
because there you're discussing results.
Yes, of course.
Right?
Yeah,
and you're discussing samples collected and things like that.
Yeah.
So that doesn't actually need a physical. Now, there's a lot of advantages to that, right? If you think about the advantages, right? The person doesn't have to take a day off to come to the doctor's office and then wait, find parking. there's a lot of pain that you're actually eradicating.
Totally.
You could actually be at work and receive the phone call and deal with it. So you didn't actually lose. This is a huge productivity gain.
And I'm sure your wife's rooms are very, very different, but all the doctors I go to, you got to spend half an hour, 45 minutes in the waiting room before you can get in, right?
You know, like there's patient after patient that you're seeing, you are waiting, you have to find parking.
For sure.
It is a productivity gain. So I get it, all the parking, parking lots are going to be empty, and those people making, Wilson's Parking makes money off parking, they're not going to be happy with this. But in my view, this is there's a productivity gain for everyone here. I think that's a big thing. So telehealth, I think, is a big deal. So those are the things that I think can get a lift.
I like it. I'm a philistine on telehealth, I've got to say. If I got something wrong with me, I want to actually go and talk to the doctor so they can look, feel, touch, check. I don't want to call a doctor on Skype.
Just do it on FaceTime. I know Skype is not that great, but you can do it on FaceTime. It'll work fine.
Until the doctor reads through the screen.
Even your prime minister has recommended FaceTime.
Is that a recommendation or not?
Well, he said we should have parties on FaceTime. My
question is, should we be listening to that or should we do the opposite?
No, I think you should do that. I am recommending that as well.
All right, very good. I have not a great deal to add. I'm going to add a couple of thoughts. I think to some degree, Doc's point is really valid, because during SARS and other things, telecommuting was supposed to be all over after SARS, right? 2003, I think it was, Doc. That was supposed to be the time when we all stopped traveling. We all used, what was it, Skype at the time? It must have been, or MSN Messenger or something, whatever it was at the time. That was supposed to be the future and never really eventuated. We were traveling more than we ever have, at least until a couple of months ago. Maybe, as Doc says, the length of this one is the difference. I would probably send a note of caution, maybe because I'm being contrarian for the sake of it, but just be careful about extrapolating too far and paying too high a price for those potential futures in and of themselves on that acceleration. So some of those will happen, some won't, or if they do happen, they may happen slower than you imagine. We have electric cars now, but we sort of have flying cars that would have been promised years ago. Of course, we also have the entire world's knowledge in our pockets on our phones. So things do tend to accelerate different rates, right? And the fact they're going to happen at some point in the future, I'm sure we'll use telehealth at some point in the future. Is that a year away? Is it 10 years away? Is it 100 years away? I don't know. I don't really have a view. So I'm not suggesting Doc's wrong or right on this one, more just that broadly, the fact the trend is real doesn't mean necessarily will be accelerated or to the degree you think. The other one is, for me, from an investing perspective, I don't think we mentioned this on Friday, mate, but the lessons we're supposed to learn from these things, investors in particular are terrible at this. You know, for those of us who are old enough, 1987 was supposed to be the end of conspicuous consumption, right? We were supposed to have learned our lessons. Wall Street, the movie, was supposed to be a cautionary tale. In fact, what it did was inspired a whole generation of traders who wanted to go and make a fortune on Wall Street being Gordon Gekko. Gekko was supposed to be the anti-hero. He turned out to be a hero for a couple of generations of Wall Street traders. So, you know, make of that what you will. To some degree, the lessons we think we're going to learn, we don't necessarily. Up to Doc's point, though, you know, it is moving in that direction. To some degree, as you've already mentioned, mate, the work from home thing. I mean, The Fool's been a work from home business in Australia since we started, effectively. We have a small office up on the Gold Coast, but most of us work from home. You and I work from home every day of the week. We always have the whole office literally in our pocket. I can pick up, I've got a, not to throw a brand at you, mate, but I've got a Chromebook, as you well know, and our listeners may or may not know. It literally has nothing installed on it other than Chrome and a couple of bits and pieces. I can do my entire job from a network connected device. I don't have anything stored on my local drive. It all does its own thing by itself. Again, whether it's a Chromebook or not, the reason I use that as an example is because it doesn't have the kind of Word or Outlook or anything loaded on it that we otherwise would use. Literally everything's available on the web. Now, The Fool was a bit ahead of time for that, probably because we're a new internet-based business. We always kind of have been since 93. But there is some reality to that, right? If other businesses start doing the same thing, that's kind of where we end up.
Yeah. I don't have much to add to that. Yeah, I think your point about paying the right price, you don't want to overpay for stuff. I think that's spot on. Like, I mean, you know, you can look at the future, you can look at the future growth opportunities, but I mean, you can't pay infinite dollars for even that future opportunities, right? So you need to pay.
Right. And I must say, I guess it's more so much, I mean, the price, I just want to just draw people's attention to some of the trends we expect won't work out the way we think. I would be a little bit hesitant for people to jump on these things and like, obviously this will happen. Some will absolutely. Some will happen for a little while, but slower pace than you expect. And others will kind of die away. You know, Skype was, I think it was sold for $8 billion to eBay at some point.
To Microsoft, I think.
No, eBay first, then eBay sold it to Microsoft.
Oh, was it sold to eBay? Okay, I didn't know that.
eBay paid
a
fortune. I think Microsoft got the better deal of that. Anyway, in any case, the point was kind of at that point, that was supposed to be the new big thing. Now, telecommuting, Zoom, that has become a new thing, but how you invested in that to work, slightly different.
I'm still amazed. What would have eBay, which is a buyer-seller platform, got to do with the...
I think the idea was supposed to connect buyers and sellers. That was the idea. It was supposed to be this technology that would allow you to maybe chat about your purchase or something. I don't really know. I'm pretty sure that's true. Correct me if I'm wrong. Feel free to hit me up on social media and make me look like a dill if I'm wrong about that. But I think that's right. We'll let someone else decide for us. Should we do that? All right, mate, time for another question. This one, we're going to go to, as much as I love the socials, we're going to go to our emails and an email from some of our listeners. We haven't addressed some of those for a little while. All right, what do we start with? Let's see. We've got so many guys. It's a great, great list. All right, here we go. A question for the podcast, no name, no last name, please. And luckily, our wonderful, hardworking member services team haven't given me your last name, so all I can call you is Ian, which is good because that's my young bloke's name too. Love listening to you guys from London. Keeps me in touch with what's going on back home. Mate, hopefully you're doing okay in London as we speak, because I know you guys are in lockdown there as well. A question about Corona. Is the only question that matters about Corona whether you have lemon or lime in it? Which one do you put in your Coronas? There you go, Doc. A lighthearted Corona question. This is about the beer, not about the virus. Funnily enough, speaking about human nature, mate, like I love people and I think we're all very special flowers. Mm. Apparently the Corona beer sales fell 15% in the wake of the coronavirus.
Well, that's very interesting.
That's the power of subconscious. I don't think anyone consciously says, I'm not going to drink the beer in case I get the virus. I mean, maybe there's 1 in every 1,000 people who genuinely thinks that. Everybody else, that's the power of suggestion. That's the power of like, when we think we're all rational creatures, right? And we think everyone else is as well. Even if you think you are, trust me, other people aren't. Anyway, massive tangent. Doc, lemon or lime?
So Ian, I'd take some maybe lime with it. Actually, you know, none would have been my answer. But if maybe some lemon maybe on the side. I'm not a big fan of Corona, the beer itself.
Yeah, me either.
I like more pale ale type of others, you know, stuff. Or like, you know, I have a Stella maybe.
Stella. Very good.
Yeah, but yeah, that's my answer.
And the only good thing to do with the Corona is give it to somebody else and drink it to his old mate. Is my. You probably can't get it over there, and I'm sorry if you can't. Although you are very, very close to the home of Guinness, and you'll know this, Ian. Maybe other listeners may or may not know this. A Guinness extra cold out of the tap in a London pub is very, very hard to go past. I'll just from experience, I may have had a couple when I worked there a decade or so ago, and I kept the brewery afloat for a bit with my work colleagues at the time, and it was a lovely place to have a nice extra cold Guinness. All right, mate, let's move on to a different question. Question from Todd. Hi, Scott and Doc. Thanks for the recent podcast and the Q&A sessions. I'm really enjoying them. I'm a brand new fool. I joined in February this year. I now have a diversified portfolio as a result. However, prior to becoming a fool, I built up a significant shareholding in NAB with an average price of about $26. I know it's not a recommended share by your company, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on selling out and buying into something else, or should I stay the course? Do you think it will recover? Or do you think my money will work better somewhere else? Thanks in advance, Todd.
Oh,
you know it's going to be a tough answer when Doc starts that way.
Yeah. So I have not looked at the recent price of NAB. But here's my thinking with the banks right now. And, you know, again, this is like trying to make a prediction, which is really hard to make a prediction. But there are a number of things that I think are significant headwinds for the bank. So like, for example, this morning, the New Zealand government basically said that New Zealand banks should not be paying dividends, right? And that's basically a way of saying that you need to preserve capital, right? And the thing that I think I am most concerned about is the flow-on effects of the coronavirus lockdown. So a flow-on effect, by that I mean there's a lot of debt in the commercial real estate sector. There's a lot of debt in the home sector. And we have, on the home front, we have some of the highest debt to disposable income. And here, the disposable income was the pre-coronavirus disposable income. So therefore, that debt to disposable income probably has shrunk now for some people. That really puts the real estate market on notice, at least in, as far as I'm concerned. So now I understand that there's backstop here of some form or the other. You know, the banks are working with the government to say that, well, if you can't pay your rent, then we defer it. We still charge interest. That's what I understand what the big banks are doing. We still charge interest. We extend your term. But it basically, it's effectively pushing the can down further down the road. It's not addressing any problem. It's in fact compounding the problem, right, to some extent. Now, of course, nobody wants like all of these things to, you know, blow up at the same time, because that would be an absolute disaster. But there is a scenario in which the banks get hammered because their bad debts rise. Now, the fact is that their bad debts are going to rise. That is almost a given. The question really is by how much and what's going to happen to the banks. Now, I think of the lot, last time I had looked, I think NAB was the cheapest or one of the cheapest in terms of book value.
It's there or thereabouts,
It's a 0.7 or 0.8 of book value. And of course, the book value is the assets and how do you value, which is the loans, and how do you, I'm almost certain that the assets probably are going to be revalued, right?
So, now, at the moment, so let's break that down a second. So at a 0.7 or 0.8 of book value, what they're really saying is you're buying a dollar's worth of NAB assets. So that if you look at the financial accounts, and you'll get to why they're going to be written down in a second, but at the moment, if you took the balance sheet and said there's a dollar's worth of assets on the balance sheet, you could buy that dollar for only 70 or 80 cents.
Exactly.
Ordinarily, if you said to me, Scott, I've got 100 bucks in my back pocket, you can buy it from me for 70 bucks. I'd happily do that swap.
Yeah.
But you're saying maybe not all is as it seems, or may not be as it seems.
Exactly. So right now the market is basically saying that, hey, it looks like you are giving me a dollar's asset worth for 70 cents, but I kind of don't believe your dollar worth of assets, because I think it's actually worth 80% of the dollar.
Right.
So effectively, that gives you an idea of what the market is thinking. Now, you know, is the market correct? Could the market be overestimating, underestimating? I really don't know. I do think personally that there are a lot of flow-on effects in the sense that, you know, for example, there'll be property investors who would have been renting stuff out on say Airbnb, which has completely fallen down, you know, evaporated, right? Now, so they are not collecting any rent. Now they might have mortgages to pay, but if they were also living on the income that they were making, well, they don't have no income. So what would they be wanting to do? Probably want to sell some assets. All you need is a bunch of people to be interested in selling assets at fire sale prices, and that can actually spiral, right?
Or you simply get bad debts altogether, right? So NAB doesn't own any of that property, but it's got loans, and it says, well, I've got $100 worth of loans out there, and those people are paying back the $100, and the market says, okay, well, I'll buy $100 worth of loans for $70. That makes some sense. What you're saying here is that, you know, people wonder, how can the asset value go away? It goes away because the $100 with the loans you think you have, either, well, essentially won't get paid back, or if you have to foreclose on the loan and sell the asset, you may not get the value back. So in fact, you may only expect to get $70 with the $100 with the loans repaid, hence the discount to book value.
Yeah, exactly. So right now, if I have to think of problems, I think there's an unemployment problem, but there's a business problem of business, essentially economy being stalled. But I think there's a credit problem that could brew, and credit problems are always very complicated, because that really makes things further complicated. So I'm not owning any bank at this price that, you know, what would you do? I don't want to poison making that suggestion.
Yeah, right.
I am, you know, the banks look cheap in my view, but I'm not a bank investor. My theory is that here's the thing, right? The government could let NAB fail. In the sense that, you know, basically shareholders make nothing on it and guarantee the deposits, which they already do, and, you know, bail it at half the current share price, for example. That could, you know, could happen. Has happened in other countries, right? And, you know, I would not assume that any bank is sacred for that reason, I think. So, yeah, I am not holding any banks. I don't have a buy on any bank. I'm not buying any bank. I'm on the skeptical side. Mm. Let's put it that way.
I think that's right, mate. I think I agree on almost all of that. I think it's remarkably if banks lose 30% of their loan values across the board, then they're effectively going to go broke. They don't have enough equity to cover that. So to some degree, the deal you're making right now with buying banks at 0.7 is that you're kind of betting against effectively bankruptcy / government bailout. Because if they're not bailed out, there's almost, I can't imagine a scenario, Doc, in which you end up with 30% of a loan book going bad and still staying in business. The equity levels are about, I want to say mid-teens, 15, 17%, something like that. So by definition, if you lose 30% of your loan book and your loan book's only covered 15% by equity, you're effectively going to go broke as an institution.
I would say it's even 10%. Basically, at 10% bad loans, I think the banks will
now,
be in trouble.
Now, if you're getting like a 30% discount to buy that bank, then that's and stays in business, then that's a decent discount. Even if you get to that 10% or something less than that, you're still well and truly covered for that decline. That being said, I think my thought about the question, which is, it's a great question, Doc. I actually don't disagree with your advice generally, other than there's probably some opportunity, is probably the best word, to think about the banks as a group rather than individually. I would, if I could buy the banking sector as a group at 0.7 times book, I don't think that'd be a bad investment. Sorry, I don't think it'd be a money-losing investment overall. Because if it is, then as a group, if one bank goes bust, you know, and it gets bailed out, you've probably still got enough discount with the other three, bought in equal phases, stages, to be okay. If two go broke, you're in trouble. If three go broke, well, you know, the whole economy's in more trouble than Superman, and we're in a different situation altogether. So at some level, to imagine that you couldn't buy all the banks at 0.7 and make some money, as long as the absolute worst doesn't happen to the economy and the country as a whole, would be unlikely. That being said, I don't think you necessarily need to take that risk, and I don't necessarily think you're going to get market-beating returns from the banks by doing so. So if that kind of makes sense, I don't think you only own one, which I think is problematic. I think the sector as a whole is probably money-making, buying at today's price, but maybe over the long term, maybe not much money. So I don't think there's enough reason to buy them right now. I don't think there's enough reason to hold particularly only a single bank right now. So again, we can't tell you what you should do. I don't own any banks personally, neither does Doc. Only one of our services do we own any bank shares. It's a very small percentage of the portfolio. That was for income reasons. So that may not survive either, by the way. Overall, I think I just don't see enough reason to own the banks or hold the banks when there's better opportunities out there. I would be diversifying away from them if it was me.
Yeah, I was going to add one more thing. You know, another thing is that even if the book value corrects, right, and let's say it corrects to 1.2, right, or 1.3, like I think one of the things that has happened over the past bull market is I think the banks have enjoyed a very high premium relative to banks elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
Right? And personally, I think there's no reason for that to be the case. And that could be investor optimism, especially when you consider in the context of sort of debt to disposable income and things like that. There's and especially these being retail banks, mostly retail banks, largely retail banks, there's again no reason for that premium to be there, but the premium was there.
Yep.
Now, in our mind, there's always this bias that we think that, well, you know, if the bank reverts back to that premium, then of course you're going to make a lot of money. But what if it does not revert back to that premium? There is always that what if part involved. And the reason I'm pointing this out is the banks may have lost, say, 30, 40% of their value, but so has the other parts of the market. There are actually some growth stocks which have lost 50, 60% of their value.
Yeah.
Probably they are better buys.
Right, exactly.
So in a bargain market,
yep.
when there's bargains everywhere, you just don't have to pick. You don't have to pick a riskier bet in that sense, right? I mean, this appears to be a risky bet versus, you know, maybe something else, right? Or, you know, maybe more upside versus downside, you know, protection. So, I mean, something to think about is when there's a sale, why do you need to pick this? You could pick something else.
Correct. I think and that's right. That was kind of the point I was trying to make I don't think it's necessarily a great idea. I do think they're probably money making on average. But again, if that's all you're trying to do, there's other ways to make a little bit of money. If you're trying to, look, as I said, I think on Friday, frankly, just a broad market ETF, you know, it's going to make money when the market rises is enough. You want to at least do that, right? Because it's just, it's not exactly shooting fish in a barrel. I shouldn't seem to seem cavalier about it, because there's no, you know, there's no reason why it has to do that. It doesn't have to do that. It could go lower in the meantime. But broadly, if you can get a market return when the market goes back to and then above previous highs, which is my expectation, then you're only doing better than that with individual stocks. And I don't think the banks are in the foreground. They're not the vanguard of stocks most likely to do that, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think I agree with that, right? I mean, if I had to pick something, I'd, you know, between the, if those were the two choices, the diversified market is a much better option, right?
Yep.
Because, again, over the long term, we know the market typically rises, right? And if it doesn't rise, then we have bigger problems.
Correct. You don't be caught in that scenario. Exactly. Yeah. That's the hard part. All right. Question, email anyway. Email from Dave. Scott, I want to turn to ride the trusty steed. Oh dear, to ride the trusty steed. It's on the high horse. My irritation is the misuse of mean versus median. In listening to the podcast, great listening by the way, I've heard you say several times that 9 out of 10 drivers consider themselves to be above average drivers. The implication is that is not possible, but in fact it is. Dave makes a very good point, and you know, he says, of course, it's possible if the 1 in 10 were so much better than the 9 poor ones and you average those out, it's entirely possible. If you average the numbers 1 in 100, you're going to get 50 and a half. If you average the numbers 1 million and 100, you're going to get 500,000, give or take. So it's possible for the number to be different. And yes, you can be far enough above the average to matter. Median and mean are very different things. Dave, I appreciate that you, I think, knew that my point was that, just to make the broad point, but yes, I should say the median driver rather than the average driver when I'm talking about 9 out of 10 being better than median, not average. All right. There's a interesting question from Blake, who directs this to you, Doc. I don't know if you have an answer to this, so I'll ask it. He says, hi, Nibun. Thanks for the recommendations. I'm enjoying following these and buying when I can. Hopefully, it sounds like Blake's a member of Extreme Opportunities, your service, which... quick ad, our listeners can get a good deal on by going to fool.com.au/EO podcast. That's EO for Extreme Opportunities, Doc Service. fool.com.au/EO podcast. All right. A quick question. Do you have one share that has the potential to be the biggest of them all in the next 5 to 10 years? I understand the risks, etc., but thought I would see if you have one stock that could be the best if things go well. Thanks and appreciate the feedback, Blake. Well, that's your question, mate, rather than mine. What one stock, if you're prepared to put your neck on the line, Doc, has the potential to be the biggest of them all in 5 to 10 years?
This is hard because, I mean...
I asked you, mate.
So, like, here, I mean, I can give multiple answers, but the thing here, the problem with this question, or the answer to this question, really, there's no problem with that question. The question is just fine, is, I mean, something could, like, I could think that it could, say 10x,
yes,
but the probability that 10x is probably low, right? So I mean, so it has the highest upside potential, but the potential is like, you know, there's a range of outcomes possible, and maybe the 10x is only like, either in my view, 10%,
yep,
right?
Yeah. Right.
So at looking through, I'm just trying to look through and see which ones. Well. this is hard, actually. So one that I think I like a couple of them. So I think Volpara could do really well. A couple of reasons for Volpara Health Technologies. So the code is VHT. They acquired this company called MRS, which basically provides a patient information system to breast cancer clinics that helps them, you know, gets their door across a larger base, and then they can cross sell their Volpara enterprise solution, which basically is used for breast screening imaging.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, so this is a relatively small company, but it provides a software solution that is essential, right? So as long as breast cancer is a problem, these two solutions are necessary, right? You need a patient information system, and you need a patient information system that talks to this imaging information system. Then So I think that creates a long runway for opportunity. It creates a recurring revenue stream. There is recognition that this is a big problem. So, you know, I think this is a business that can 10x from here. It would be still relatively small on a sort of a global scale. If you think about of a software, medical imaging, you know, a medical software business, and those can be nice and nicely cash generative. It is none of those things at this point. So I think that is one possibility in terms of what could 10x. Again, you have to remember that this is not necessarily going to definitely do that, but I think this is a potential. The thing I'd point out is many of the most of the stocks we recommend, we are really swinging, which we think, you know, they should be high multi-baggers, fully realizing that some of them are not going to make it. In fact, you know, we say that 4 out of 10 is sort of what the strike rate we are trying to, you know, we think we're going to achieve. And the other one that I think is fairly interesting is a company called Big Tin Can. So
that has got one of my least favorite names of any company in the ASX, dog. Tin Can.
Big and tin and can.
Come on.
So the reason I think that's interesting is a couple of reasons. They provide what's called sales enablement software. So basically, this is software that salespeople use for, you know, essentially making sales and deals and so on. So and it allows collaboration between various salespeople, sharing of information, sharing of data, sharing of processes. It is basically, you know, a step above sort of doing, you know, CRM, right? Customer relationship management, right? It's just a sort of, you know, a step, I guess the step before that, right? You know, and it could be the same customers that you're trying to sell to, in which case it's an upsell. Again, the reason I like this company is it is providing a software solution. So it's a relatively capital light company. It has got a bunch of modules targeting a bunch of different sectors. Mm. Now, again, we have to remember a lot of these sectors right now are closed or not performing at or not operating at, so, you know, growth can be hit. They came out with an announcement suggesting that they have, you know, they're still likely to meet their growth targets, or they said that they reaffirmed their growth targets. They're going to make, they meet it. They are able to remotely work out still. And again, I would expect that if sales enablement is actually making a difference, then you'd think the churn for this sort of software is going to be low. The reason I think this can be a 10x is basically the valuation is relatively cheap for a SaaS type of software type of company. So if you think from a valuation point of view, is relatively cheap, and, you know, maybe a 10x is possible. You know, so again, if not a 10x, maybe a 5x is quite possible. If the company is around and growing sort of at the current rate, then a 5x is possible. So sort of to give you, so those sort of are the two ideas.
So that's Volpara, which is code VHT, and Big Tin Cam, which I almost can't bring myself to say, but I will. BTH is the
BTH
code,
BTH is the code. So those are sort of two ideas. There are a bunch of others. Again, I like sort of all the companies that we have on buy. Not, you know, we have a bunch of companies on hold, largely because of coronavirus situation. So, I do think that the buys that we have currently got are at good value point. Again, I wouldn't, you know, want to talk about more because then I'm going to be releasing more of the scorecard. I guess this, I can talk about one more.
So you got it going, Blake. You can't stop now.
So I'm going to talk about one more. This one I think is interesting because so this is a company called a Goat Milk Company. Now, you know, Scott is already laughing. Goat Milk, called Bubs.
Code is BUB.
BUB. This I think is interesting because there's a strong demand for their product. They own pretty much almost all the goat milk in Australia and New Zealand, or majority of the goat milk in Australia and New Zealand. So as long as that category of goat milk from this part of the world is in demand, I think they're likely to do well. They've got some strong partnerships, especially in the Asian market, which again puts them in a good footing, I think. Again, I think, you know, this. I see some similarities here between sort of, you know, an early A2, A2 milk, and A2 milk, for example, has been a huge success. If you bought A2 milk, say, you know, 5 years ago, then it's probably a 10 bagger for you. So sort of that sort of view. For full disclosure, again, disclosure is important here. I personally own shares in Bubs. Again, mm-hmm. you know, none of these companies. I'd add one more caution. I own shares that does, you know, don't assume that to mean that, you know, you should go like all in back the truck. The reason I say that is these are riskier companies, so you should size your positions accordingly. Again, you know, what accordingly is, it depends on the business. So my positions are small in Bubs, and I do own my position in Volpara is slightly bigger, but that's because, you know, I've owned it for a long time and it's been actually a good winner. Mm. So that is slightly bigger, but again, it's still a relatively small position to, you know, some of my larger positions. So again, I own those two. I don't actually own Big Tin Can. However, I'll add a caveat. I've tried, you know, the platform on which I buy the stock, they don't actually provide Big Tin Can. They've never provided. And there have been a number of times when I've wanted to buy it, and I just couldn't buy it because my broker doesn't have that stock available to me. So I've just given up on it, saying, well, and I could buy it on another broker platform, but you know, how many broker platforms do you want to manage? So.
A good reminder when you're choosing brokers to make sure you actually can get the stocks you're looking for.
Yeah, like this broker platform actually has some liquidity, you know, like even right. super, you know, if you're buying stuff in Super, for example, yep. they would sometimes cut off stuff for you because it doesn't, you know, they believe that, you know, it has to have certain amount of liquidity.
There you
brokers
go.
Can do a lot of things.
Three stocks from Doc for absolutely free. How good is that? I'm going to say something, mate, that you may or may not agree with, but I think you'll agree. All I would say, Blake, is great question, but please, for the love of God, don't just buy one or two or three stocks and hope to make money. Doc's already said that EO, he expects 4 out of 10 to be the strike rate. In other words, more are going to lose than win, but he believes strongly, and certainly evidence backs this out, that if he does it well, and he does do it well, that the winners will more than pay for the losers and leave lots of money left over to beat the market on top of that. That's the way they're investing. So I have no doubt of his conviction in those three stocks, but I would imagine, mate, you would think just probabilistically at least one of those doesn't do anywhere near as well as you think?
I think what you said is absolutely correct, right? I mean, again, that's why I said the position sizing is important.
Correct.
And what you're saying is that you should be diversified.
Correct. Yeah,
don't back the truck.
Yep.
Don't buy one stock.
Correct.
You know, even if I have super high conviction to say that Bubs is going to be like a 100 bagger, I wouldn't say tell anyone that you should put all your money in, you know.
And quite honestly, mate, you and I had a very high level of conviction Webjet 4 months ago.
Oh, yeah, like, I mean,
even outside, you know, something outside the company's control could always come and hit companies. So.
Yeah, the stuff that can happen that no one sees.
Yeah.
And, you know, investing can be very humbling, right? I mean, you know, it's very humbling.
We know that,
on
absolutely.
This very podcast,
yes.
I've said multiple times,
yes.
I like the company.
Exactly.
Right? And I think it's doing a great job. It's growing very well.
Exactly.
Its WebBeds business is fantastic. You know, and again.
And yet,
here we are. I'm actually happy to see that the stock has not fallen to 175, which is a small win.
Yes. The more I think about diversification is the right word. The more I think about this, the more I think the most important word in investing, maybe second most, temperament's probably still number one, is portfolio, right? Just like for everything that we talk about, for all the stocks that we talk about, for all of our high conviction, you know, we don't own just one or two or three stocks each, even though Doc said, you know, those are his three best ideas. He owns two of those three. But I dare say, mate, there's small proportions of your total portfolio in some, and we want our members and our listeners to be investing similarly.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I reckon this might be the last one, mate. We'll see how we go for timing. This one comes from Stephen. I love this question because sometimes we do assume, we try to explain our terms when we're going. We don't necessarily always explain our approach or the philosophy behind what we do. So Stephen says, hi, Doc and Scott. He says, in brackets, I thought it was time to reverse the order. That's probably fair. Yes, yes, love the podcast, etc. Well, you know, we all do. Stephen, we all like to be told. We all like to be told. You know, it's Billy Joel's song, Tell Her About It. Tell her everything she means. You know, just give us, you know, we don't exist in a vacuum. Anyway, Stephen says, one question for you. Why the obsession with beating the market? Surely if you're managing decent returns that are ahead of term deposit rates, then that's enough. I know fund managers use the index as a benchmark to entice you to place funds with them rather than an ETF with the air quotes promise that you'll do better with them than with Vanguard. But really, why should the average investor care? Looking forward to your discussion, Stephen. Doc, why on earth are we obsessed with beating the market?
Stephen, this is a fantastic question, actually. A really hard one.
Yeah.
Mate, this is a great question to ask. You know, in all honesty, for many people, this is, you know, and we're probably one of the few businesses we can actually say this, and probably I wouldn't get fired. Maybe we'll figure out next week.
Stand by. I don't know what he's going to say yet. So it might be the Scott point. You better hope, for everyone out there who likes listening to Doc, you better hope he doesn't say anything that gets him fired.
So here's the interesting, you know, maybe our co-founder and CEO will also back me on this. For a section of investors, probably investing in index funds and being invested and just getting market returns, which delivers better returns than a term deposit or any other cash asset, is probably fantastic, right? And it's fantastic because the alternative is, if you didn't do that, you just lost out on making 8-9% or whatever the market is going to deliver. So you absolutely, I think, that is a great starting point for anybody who doesn't have the time, inclination, ability, willingness, or whatever.
Yep.
That is absolutely great. You should absolutely do that. So that answers the first part. Now, I think that, you know, if somebody doesn't want to do that and they have no inclination to get the 2% extra or 3% extra or 1% extra, I would say go and do an ETF and or a couple of ETFs and something like that. Yep. Now, why is the obsession?
Why do you want to beat the market, Doc? Tell us.
First of all, it's a great sport. I love that sport. A sport is fantastic. But there's a little thing here. If somebody is investing, now I don't have a calculator here, but
I'm about to pull it up now. I've had the same idea, mate. Yeah, so you keep talking and I'll do some looking.
So here's the thing. Somebody's investing for 30 years and getting 7% returns or 8%. Let's assume the market's going to do 8%. I like to say 8%. Scott likes to say 10%. I love to say 8% because I just like to say 8%.
We're among friends. Let's go with it.
So if you get 1% extra, I would bet that over a 30-year period, that is a substantial amount of extra money.
Right.
2% extra would be phenomenally extra money. And if you get 3% extra, you're probably dancing on the moon or the equivalent of that, 3 or 4%, right? Because of the fact, the sheer fact of compounding. Now, this, you know, if you just do this math with, I can do it off the top of my head. If you are doubling your money, say, at... not doubling. If you're getting a 9% return, then you double your money every 8 years. Yep. But if you get a 12% return, you double your money every 6 years, right? And that really starts taking an impact if you take a long-term view. So in fact, for somebody with a 30-year horizon, this can actually have a substantial life-changing wealth impact. Right.
Yeah, correct.
And that's the reason, the obsession with beating the market. There's another reason here. And that is, if you think about the market, right? The Australian market, let's say, has 1,800 companies, I think, roughly, give or take a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to own all 1,800 because if you really think hard and, you know, at any given point in time, you could probably make a list, 30-odd companies that would probably together are great companies, good companies that are delivering good returns, going to likely deliver good returns and do better than owning 1,800. So why do you need to own 1,800 if you can get better results by owning those 30-odd companies as an example, right? All of those reasons, but, you know, mostly compounding and time is the main reason I would say that, you know, we're obsessed with beating the market because, again, it makes a difference, makes a big difference.
Yep. I'm going to just give you some numbers, mate, because you've absolutely nailed it. So, well, first things first, I think matching the market is wonderful. And when you try and beat the market, you can also lose to the market. So there's that risk you're taking. You're taking it for extra upside, and I think it's worth trying for most people if you have, as Doc's already said, the inclination, the interest, the ability to do so. So let's take a 40-year time horizon just for fun, Doc. If we invested 10 grand today, let's go 10 grand. I'm changing my numbers. I'm speaking, mate. This is real time Excel.
This is real time work.
This is how it all happens, right? If you were to invest 10 grand today and you get 8% a year, in 40 years' time, that money is, as I desperately screw up my spreadsheet, this is real time. All right. If you invest 8%, I've done it again. I pressed some button. It's going strange on me. All right. Third time lucky. If you invest 8% for 40 years, 10 grand becomes $217,000. Now, that's worth stopping alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you just get the market return, you get a 20-fold return on your cash, 20-fold over 40 years. Who doesn't want to do that? So that's the first thing, right? 8%, 217 grand. I'll give Doc this one. So let's assume the market's going to do 8%. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good return. If you invest 20 grand, it's 400 grand. Mm-hmm. If you invest 50 grand, that's $1 million. And again, you're not going to just add it once. You're going to add over your lifetime. But this is just very, very simple. One off, put money in, leave it there. 10 grand, 200. If you get 9%, okay, that's one percentage point more. If you want to do the math, that's 12.5% greater return between 8 and 9, right? But the money doesn't go up by 12%. It doesn't go up by 50%. It does go up by 50%. You go from 217,000 to 314,000. If you can get one percentage point more return, you get 50% more cash, right? That's 9%. At 10%, you get 50% again more cash. So at 10% over 40 years, $450,000. Now let's go back to the original 8. Between 8 and 10%, that's a 20% higher, 25% higher return. You're getting more than double the amount of money at the end of the process. So you don't have to get double the return to get double the money. The way compounding works, instead of 217 grand at 8, you're getting $450,000 at 10%. Let's say you get 12%, to Doc's point. That 10 grand becomes $930,000. If you can compound at 12% for 40 years, and frankly, that's not easy. I'm not saying everyone can do it. Some people shouldn't try. Some people just will try and fail. But if you could get 12% for that long, your $217,000 becomes instead $930,000. It's a 93 times return compared to a 20 times return, just for getting extra 4 percentage points of annualized investment return on your cash. And that, in a nutshell, is exactly why it's super worth doing. Now, Stephen, you might say it's being greedy. That might be arguable. You might say it's too hard. That might be arguable. You might say it's too risky. That also might be arguable. But that, in black and white, is exactly why many people, including us, decide that it's worth having a go. Because, you know, if you don't manage to and you get just the market return instead, you know, worse off. You can absolutely be worse off. For many people, if you can invest for 5 years and can't beat the market, I'd probably say, you know what, it's time to go and play golf, take up another hobby, to Doc's point, choose a different sport, and just invest in the market. You'll get a great return. I think the market's going to be closer to 10 than 8, but it doesn't matter what it is. Well, it doesn't mean in dollar terms, but broadly speaking, the market return is there. Effectively risk-free. It's not volatility-free, but it's effectively risk-free. You can get a really, really nice return from the market just by regularly adding cash and going fishing. But if you make the effort and you can do it, the rewards are phenomenally worthwhile for those who can achieve a better than benchmark return.
I have nothing to add to that.
If that's the case, mate, we might call it quits. What do you reckon?
We should. I think this is the greatest point of the podcast, I guess, in that sense. and we should call it quits here.
There you go. With that $930,000 bait, we call it bait.
It's a bait
incentive.
It's a true incentive.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, right. Yeah. So like with that dangling in front of you, if it's not worth trying, I don't know what is. Again, make sure you're good at it. You don't want to lose money, but remember that's the sort of reward on offer if you can do it well. That's what we're trying to do at the Motley Fool, of course, and we're biased, right? But I'll say the same thing for Doc. I'm pretty sure it's true for him. I'm not a guy who works for the Motley Fool who therefore is a shares guy. I was a customer of the Motley Fool. I was a member of the Motley Fool. I believe in what we're doing. I joined the Motley Fool, took a pay cut to do it because I wanted to help other people see the value I saw. So people say, oh, you're a shares guy. Of course you'd say that. Well, it's kind of the reverse, right? I'm a shares guy because I know that's true. All right. Any more? Do you want
to? I think that's the same story for me. I mean, you know, I'm a shares guy because
right.
I saw that there's
it's
a value.
Right?
It's very compelling. There is something here. And it's interesting that, you know, the other reason we do it is we want more people to realize this, and we want them to realize this as early as possible.
Right.
Because the more time you've got, the bigger the win.
Next week, I'm going to give you my superannuation idea. Hey, there's a tease for our listeners. next week, if we do a mailbag next week, we may not, if we do. I'm going to give you it's kind of a quasi high horse. I'm going to give you my superannuation idea that I think beats every other superannuation idea out there. Now, I'm not saying something you can necessarily follow. I don't want to be a bait and switch. I'm not saying that everyone should listen because they're going to get some great investment insight. I'm going to give you a policy insight into how the government could fix super next week.
Cool.
Looking forward to that?
I like that idea.
We're done. Before you go, though, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. If you like what we're doing, tell your friends, leave us a rating, leave us a review, write it in skywriting above the major capital cities of the country. If you've got a plane, a skywriting plane, just get out there and I think MMM, Triple M, then MFM, Motley Fool Money would be great. If you can take a photo, if you really care, if you really love us, you'll do it for us. I know you will. Those of you who had skywriting planes, if you don't have a skywriting plane, just feel free to I don't know, change your number plate or I don't know, send your friends an email or social media, something. Too much talk?
No. It's not too much.
And, of course, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox and an offer to join Dividend Investor by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.